Hey there, it's Joshua. Before we start the podcast, a quick announcement for our listeners in the Washington, D.C. area who will be in town around November 29th. You can catch me live on stage alongside Michael Barbaro, the host of The Daily from the New York Times. We'll be joined by Peter Baker and Michaela Bouchard from The Times and Katty Kay from BBC News, talking about the latest news, and we'll give you some insights into how we do what we do. Again, that's November 29th at the Lincoln Theater in Washington. For tickets and more information, go to the1a.org. Thanks. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. It's been almost 2 weeks since the deadly mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. And this week marks another attack on Jews that the world should never forget. Tomorrow is the 80th anniversary of Kristallnacht, the night that anti-Jewish demonstrations broke out across Europe. 91 Jews were killed and more than 7,000 businesses were destroyed. It was a turning point in the violence against European Jews that ended with millions being sent to concentration camps. Anti-Semitism is on the rise in America. Reports suggest that attacks were up a staggering 57% last year from the year before. How are we collecting and preserving memories of the Holocaust before the survivors die? We often hear the words, never again. But how can we be so sure? We'll get into that after this.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Gelmar CLR. Whatever you call your home, Gelmar knows you take great pride in keeping it clean. That's where CLR comes in. CLR dissolves calcium, lime, and rust all around the house using natural ingredients, not harsh chemicals. It even carries the EPA's Safer Choice seal. Keep your little piece of the planet looking its best with CLR, making the world a little cleaner.
The StoryCorps podcast returns this fall with 12 all-new episodes about reunions. This week, what it's like to spend years searching for a father, only to find someone you didn't even know you were looking for. Hear more on the StoryCorps podcast. Episodes are available every Tuesday.
Joining us from Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor is Irene Butter, who also goes by Rainey. She is the author of the memoir Shores Beyond Shores, From Holocaust to Hope, My True Story. Rainey, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Joining us here in the studio is Sarah Bloomfield, the director of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. Sarah, welcome.
Glad to be with you.
And also here in studio is Alexandra Zapruder, the author of Salvaged Pages, Young Writers' Diaries of the Holocaust. She's also the guest curator of an exhibition about young diarists for the Holocaust Museum in Houston, which opens next year. Alexandra, glad to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
Rainey, let me start with you. We're going to share some of our listener stories, but we should begin with yours. Tell us what happened to your family in the Holocaust.
Well, actions against the Jews began before Kristallnacht. In 1935, Hitler took away citizenship from all German Jews. And I grew up in a family with my grandparents, my parents, and a brother 2 years older. My grandfather owned a bank, and my father was his partner. And before Kristallnacht, the bank was taken away because Jews could no longer own banks and other businesses or enter certain professions. So my father saw the writing on the wall, and he went to Amsterdam to try to find work. And we immigrated to the Netherlands in 1937. So I was not in Germany anymore during Kristallnacht, but things had become pretty difficult for Jews several years before then.
When did things begin to get difficult for your family? How did that happen?
Well, because the bank was taken away, so my father was unemployed, and many Jews were deported to concentration camp. People who were employed in the German government, Jews were fired from their jobs. And kids were beaten up in school. My brother once got beaten up in school for being Jewish. So a lot of Jews left Germany while they still could.
How much of your family ended up in concentration camps?
My parents, my brother, and myself, 2 years in Amsterdam were peaceful, relatively peaceful, and then the Nazis invaded the Netherlands. So exactly what we'd been trying to escape followed us, and the persecution escalated. We were deported to Camp Westerbork, which was a German camp in Holland, and with luck of some Ecuadorian passports that my father received from Sweden. They didn't arrive before we were deported to Westerbork, but by some miracle, they were forwarded to Camp Westerbork. This changed our status to exchange Jews. We were no longer at risk of being deported to Auschwitz and were sent to Bergen-Belsen, a German concentration camp in Germany. Part of the 8 camps that existed there was called an exchange camp. And we were there for almost 1 year under abominable conditions, hard labor, minimal food rations, crowded conditions. Everyone had lice that transmitted infectious diseases. There were epidemics, typhus, cholera. It was called a slow death camp. And then we had an incredible fortune of being included in a prisoner exchange from Bergen-Belsen. There were thousands of people who had passports similar to ours, but only 300 were selected for this transport. So that was an incredible stroke of luck. But 2 days on the train to Switzerland, my father died. And that was an immense shock for my family. He was taken off the train in a small southern town, southern Germany, and we had no choice but to continue on the journey. My mother was extremely ill and was bedridden for months in Bergen-Belsen. Mm-hmm. And so we had no choice but to continue on the train to Switzerland, at which point I was separated at age 14 from my mother and my brother because they had to be hospitalized, and I wasn't sick enough to stay with them. Ended up in a refugee camp in Algiers, and it was managed by the UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Association, where I spent 1 year before I came to America, and my mother and my brother luckily recovered. They also came to America, and after 18 months of separation, we were reunited and started a new life in New York City.
So I just want to make sure we're clear. Your mother and brother were hospitalized, you know, in Switzerland. You were sent to a refugee camp in Algeria on the northern tip of Africa.
Correct.
And you were reunited in New York. How did that reunion take place?
Well, we had relatives in America who sponsored us. They provided affidavits, which you then needed, and paid for our transportation. So I came from Algiers at the end of 1945, and it took them 6 more months to have all the immigration papers, and then they joined me in New York.
We are speaking to Irene Rainey Butter. Her new memoir is called Shores Beyond Shores, From Holocaust to Hope, My True Story. But we've also heard from some of you who are expressing concern that this history that we know of Kristallnacht and the Holocaust and the concentration camps and so forth, might repeat itself in 2018 or in the years to come based just on the way that the world is moving right now. Here is a mashup of a few calls that came into our inbox.
My name is Don. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm a Jew, grew up in Miami, and I'm 71 years old. I went to a synagogue when I was a little boy. 1955 is the year that I remember. There was a lady in our synagogue who had a tattoo on her forearm because she had been in a concentration camp. And rather than hide it, kids would ask her about it. She'd explain it and use it as a teaching moment.
My name is Larry Hanover from Cherry Hill, New Jersey. In 2010, I met a Holocaust survivor named Fred Barron, and I was stunned by his story of Kristallnacht. At age 12, he saw one synagogue after another on fire in the city of Cologne. And back home in his hometown of Lüdenscheid, His father was taken away for transport to a concentration camp.
Every Jew in the world is always looking over their shoulder. You can't help it. It's just the way it is. You never can tell when history is going to repeat itself.
The Pittsburgh shooting really shook up Fred. For the first time, he was fearful there could be another Kristallnacht, this time in America.
Thanks to Don and Larry for sharing their stories. Rainey, I wonder what you make of their concerns. That's something we heard from some of the congregants at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, that the kind of fear of looking over their shoulder was nothing new, and that the synagogue shooting just kind of spoke to that fear. What do you think?
Well, I give a lot of talks in schools and have received letters, more than few, from students who say, I went home, told my story to my parents, your story to my parents, and they had never heard of the Holocaust. So remembrance is extremely important, and Elie Wiesel always impressed on Holocaust survivor, assigned the responsibility to witness, to provide testimony, so that the dead will not die again. And I think, on the one hand, a very important job is fulfilled by the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and many children are taken there from their schools. Several states, not enough in this country, have a law that mandates the teaching of Holocaust and genocide in public schools, but there's still too many people who don't know or don't attach importance to the danger that this can repeat itself.
We've heard some of the stories from our audience about visiting the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. And of course, if you've never been, it's one of those things you absolutely have to see at some point in your life. It is heartbreaking, and it is necessary to go. Doc wrote on our website, the1a.org, about being a chaperone for their child's field trip to the museum. Doc writes, "As we toured the museum, the students were very solemn. Then we came to the shoe exhibit. One of the students in my group said, 'Oh my gosh, there are kids' shoes in there.' At that point, all four boys in my group started to weep." Before we hear from the director of the museum, Rainey, if I could just ask you one more question. I remember reading, you know, Viktor Frankl's legendary book, Man's Search for Meaning, about surviving the Holocaust and the difference in terms of the people who believed they were going to get out, who had a reason for hope, and the people who had resigned themselves to dying in that camp, and they were the ones who didn't make it. Did you believe you would make it out of that awful situation? Did you have hope for survival, or did you not know at all?
I had a dream. As a young girl, I used to read books about Heidi, and I wanted to survive and learn to ski in Switzerland. And that kept me going. Every night when I went to bed, I hoped I would wake up the next morning. And when I woke up, I saw dead people all around me. But another thing is, what gave meaning to my survival, or my attempt to survive, was that my parents were seriously ill. Their health was deteriorating day by day. And so they couldn't take care of me, but I was taking care of them, hoping that we could all survive. And that's another way of making meaning in your life, is to take care of others.
Rick wrote on our Facebook page, "My grandmother nearly broke my hand when I was a boy when I had drawn a swastika. She was mortified, and I'd never seen her more angry. I would learn as I grew older she'd been a young supporter in Germany. The regime she supported destroyed her country, and would later learn of the breadth of the Holocaust. I was never able to ask her, but I perceived a deep shame about the matter." Sarah Bloomfield, as the director of the Holocaust Memorial Museum, I wonder what you think of the concern that our two callers expressed, that there's this fear looking over one's shoulder that there could be another Kristallnacht, this time in America. I wonder what you see, what your reaction was to the shooting in Pittsburgh.
Well, first of all, after working all these years at the Holocaust Museum, it takes a lot to shock me, and I realize that anti-Semitism has been around for 2,000 years. I don't think it's an ineradicable disease. In fact, I'm not sure hate is an ineradicable disease. That, to me, is one of the challenges the museum puts before our visitors. Now that you know human beings are capable of this, what is your responsibility? And frankly, obviously the Holocaust is not possible without Nazis and what they did, but it's really not possible without the cooperation of many people and the indifference of pretty much everyone. And that's really where we all have to ask ourselves, what is our role in society? At Kristallnacht, the event you've talked about, the Germans did not express any solidarity with their fellow Jewish citizens. Of course, their citizenship had been taken away by then. None of them spoke up out of hate, out of fear, out of indifference. That, to me, is the real lesson. And that, of course, was a state-sponsored event. There's some small consolation in Pittsburgh in seeing the outpouring of people all over this country saying that this is not America, and for non-Jews standing with the Jewish community of Pittsburgh in solidarity. That's a big difference from Nazi Germany.
Alexandra Zapruder, I see you nodding your head. How do you see this?
Well, I agree with what Sarah is saying. In a lot of ways, you know, this is something that, you know, when we see something as shocking as the shooting that took place in Pittsburgh, you know, we immediately go to that very dark place about feeling vulnerable, particularly as Jews in American society. But I think Sarah's right that there's a huge difference between a state-sponsored genocide against a nation's people and an act of violence like the one that took place in Pittsburgh, which is, you know, certainly to echo what Sarah said, not to make the individual event any less horrific.
I wonder how squarely we peg this to the president's rhetoric. 5ME tweeted, "Don't worry, Trump is building tent camps here. We'll have an American Holocaust if Congress doesn't do something." I assume referring to the tent camps for immigrant families detained at the border. Sarah, how much do we put on any particular political leader, figure, noted person? I'm sorry, Alexandra, on any particular leader, figure, noted person for what we're seeing right now?
I mean, I personally feel that there is and see empiric evidence that there is a huge rise in normalizing hate speech coming from above all from the highest levels of government, from Donald Trump and from many other people across this nation. And I think that there is, you know, not only normalizing of hate speech and racism, but, you know, this enormous fear-mongering about immigrant populations that I think, and anti-Muslim sentiment that is very, very, very concerning. I've never seen anything like it in my lifetime, and I do, to some extent, hold our political leaders responsible for that.
One listener emailed, "Every year I attend the Holocaust Memorial event at the Lincoln Theater in Washington, D.C., and hear survivors' heart-wrenching stories that just pierce the soul. Their numbers are dwindling. Their testimony is to ensure that we never forget these atrocities. How ironic, and more than 70 years later, we're still faced with hatred, even in our own country." We'll continue our conversation with Holocaust survivor Rainey Butter, Alexandra Zapruder, the author of Salvaged Pages, and Sarah Bloomfield, the director of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. We'll get to more of your questions and stories as well. How do we preserve this history so that the world says never again and then acts on that? Stay close.
The following message comes from our sponsor, Capital One. The CreditWise app from Capital One recently released three new features, including a social security number tracker to help users quickly detect fraud for free. Here's head of CreditWise, Joe Whitchurch.
While identity fraud is intimidating and can sound really complex, a little bit of effort can go a long way in helping you understand if you've been a victim of identity fraud.
CreditWise is free for everyone, whether you're a Capital One customer or not. You can find CreditWise in your app or Play Store now.
Sam Sanders here. This week I'm talking to Abby Jacobson. You know her from her Comedy Central show, Broad City. We're going to talk about a solo cross-country road trip Abby took recently and why she wrote a book all about it. That is on the latest episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Back now to our conversation with Sarah Bloomfield, the director of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, Alexandra Zapruder, the author of Salvaged Pages, Young Writer's Diaries of the Holocaust, and Irene Butter, author of the memoir Shores Beyond Shores, From Holocaust to Hope, My True Story. We asked for some of your family stories. Here is one story that landed in our inbox.
My name is Al Munzer, and I'm calling from Washington, D.C. I am a child survivor of the Holocaust. I was born during the Nazi occupation of Holland, and when I was 9 months old, I was left with a Dutch Indonesian family and their Muslim nanny who risked their lives to save mine. Sadly, my two sisters, who were hidden with a different family, were denounced and were killed in Auschwitz when they were only 6 and 8. My parents were deported and my father died in a concentration camp, but my mother fortunately survived 12 concentration camps. The lesson that I take from the Holocaust is that even when surrounded by evil, like the Madna family who saved me, it is possible to stand up and do what is right.
I hear that, Al. Thanks very much for sharing your story. By the way, the Holocaust Memorial Museum is always looking for more testimonies. We have the information on how to share your story online at the1a.org. You'll also find a link to the November issue of Smithsonian Magazine, which focuses on recovering lost voices from the Holocaust. Again, that's on our website, the word the number one, the letter A, .org. Sarah Bloomfield, you wanted to jump in before we keep going.
I wanted to add something to what Alex was saying before about speech. And I think one of the questions we're facing today is the role of free speech in the era of the internet. This is posing big questions for our country. And propaganda is now something that's everywhere. The museum did a whole educational initiative looking at Nazi propaganda and how effective they were at using it. They used the latest technologies of their day. In that time, the radio was the equivalent of our cell phone. Hitler said, "Propaganda is a terrible weapon in the hands of an expert." And he would know because he's an expert. But in today's world with the internet, anyone can be an expert. And this, to me, should be a challenge to all of us. How are we going to deal with this new technology, which is changing the notion of speech all around us?
Well, it's so much harder to suss out good information online sometimes. Also harder to easier to purvey debunking information, but the battle keeps kind of escalating. Rainey, how do you see it? I mean, you lived through the lead up to the Holocaust. How does the climate in Europe then compare to what we're seeing with anti-Semitism or just general hatred now? How do you compare them?
Well, I was just a child. A young child, and I think my parents protected me a lot from what was going on, but I certainly see it now. The hatred is rampant, and it's not just against the Jews. There are so many other groups and isms that perpetuate the hatred, and I think we're at danger. So my focus of my limited energy is on young people. And I teach them not to be a bystander when they hear or see hatred being perpetuated, that they must take responsibility, they must have a social conscience. And all of us, all these groups that are being targeted, should form an alliance and stamp out hatred in any way that we can and take positive actions. Like I also transmit the message. One person can make a difference. Mm-hmm. We may think of ourselves as being very small, and the problems are so large, but any act that is taken can have ripple effects. Other people may follow, and we must all take advantage of opportunities to interrupt and intervene. And the other message is refusing to be enemies. Often we are taught that certain groups of people are enemies.
Yeah.
But we have never met them. We don't even know them. We just perpetuate the hatred. And so refusing to be enemies means that you meet people, you listen to their stories, you look into their face, and you'll find out that the differences are far smaller than what we have in common. And so those are lessons that I think I've learned from the Holocaust and try to perpetuate amongst young people.
Right. And Rainey, I'm glad that you mentioned other people besides Jews who were killed in the Holocaust. Of course, there were Sinti and Roma people, people who are commonly referred to as gypsies, Polish citizens, Soviet citizens, people with disabilities, Jehovah's Witnesses were killed in the Holocaust, LGBT people were killed in the Holocaust. So it definitely was not just Jews. It goes right to that kind of Martin Niemöller poem about, you know, first they came for the socialists, I didn't speak out, then they came for the trade unionists, then the Jews, and they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. Let me get to some more of your comments and questions now. Matt wrote on our Facebook page, "It shouldn't take the memory of the Holocaust to stop anti-Semitism. 6 million murdered Jews is not the reason it's bad to mistreat someone because of their religion. Mistreating someone on the basis of their religion or skin tone or first language or socioeconomic status or gender or sexual preference is wrong. It's supposed to be one of the foundational concepts of the U.S. It's a pinnacle concept of modern basic human rights." Kella tweeted, "While Americans may view historical genocides like the Holocaust as atrocities, most only know about them from history books. Despite current fears, do most Americans feel too far removed from these horrors? Will our apathetic, 'it won't happen here,' mindset pave the way for hate?" Interesting question, Alexandra. I wonder how you would respond to Kella, especially because it's hard to find an American who wouldn't say never again, but what does that actually mean?
Well, it's so interesting because, of course, I started my career on the founding staff of the Holocaust Memorial Museum, and that is so much the mission of the museum, is to use education and storytelling as a way to educate people and to preserve these memories. One of the things that I've done over the last 25 years is study the diaries of teenagers who wrote at the time, and we're talking about individual humanity of people. And there's something about reading a diary of a teenager who wrote during the Holocaust, and for that matter, diaries of teenagers who wrote during the siege of Sarajevo, during the war in Iraq, under ISIS in Syria, that collapses the distance between the over the years and over geographic areas, and allows you to connect in a very deep and intimate personal way with the lived life of an individual person. And that can change you. That can make you, ideally in the best case, it cultivates empathy, it cultivates compassion. And also, there was something that that Irene said that I thought was so interesting. She referred to the not allowing the dead to die again. And I think there is something so basic about our desire as human beings, no matter where you are in the political spectrum, no matter what religion, no matter what color you might be, no matter where you were born, that we want our lives to matter. We want it to matter that we were here, and we want to be remembered when we're gone. And so there is something about reading these diaries of people for whom there are only strangers to remember them because their entire communities were wiped out, that I think is fundamentally an act of humanity.
Sarah Bloomfield, how does the Holocaust Memorial Museum go about preserving these stories? Can you just talk about some of the process that goes from when someone says, "I have a story to tell," to when it becomes when it lands in your collection?
Well, first of all, thank you for doing that for us. We really have a major initiative now to address exactly what you've been talking about in this program, which is how do you do storytelling for the future, for when the survivors and the other eyewitnesses, and I want to mention a lot of World War II soldiers who liberated the camps were very important eyewitnesses. We want them to come forward and share with us their family stories, and if they have any family mementos, photographs, letters, diaries, I mean, we have a little puppet that an American soldier gave to children that he liberated in a camp in France. And we were able to reunite one of those children with the children of this American soldier through that puppet, which is now in our collection. So now we can tell a very human story and humanize this genocide, and so that people can see that this happened by human beings. Human beings did this to other human beings, whether you were good or evil or went up and down that spectrum of behavior, which is what most of us do most of the time.
Another effort to preserve the stories of the Holocaust, Susan emailed, "We should recognize Steven Spielberg's Shoah Project, his work to interview and preserve the memories of hundreds of Holocaust survivors before they are all gone, a great service to history." I think it's one of history's, I don't know if it's an irony, but it's almost one of the nice little threads of history that Steven Spielberg, who made Schindler's List, released it through Universal Pictures, which is a studio that was founded by a German Jew, Carl Laemmle, who spent some of his wealth to help German Jews escape the Nazis in World War II. Michael wrote on our Facebook page, "Racism, anti-Semitism, just fading away. This needs to be added to everyone's history curriculum so it's never forgotten. Can't afford to relearn these lessons." Larry wrote on our Facebook page, "Unfortunately, history will be repeated." Rainey, as I understand it, you write in the introduction to your memoir, after you got to the U.S., you were urged to forget everything about what you went through. Why did people at the time want you to forget? Was it just about being able to move on and rebuild your life?
Exactly. I might mention that I've met many survivors who received exactly the same message when they came to the United States at first. And I think it was well meant, but I also think the world was not ready to listen to these stories. Whatever the reasons, whether it was guilt, whether it was the unbelievability of it, the world was not ready. And it took decades before we saw movies, before we saw books published, before people were listening. Because I know whenever my mother, my brother, and I started referring to something, we were silenced. We just couldn't. It just wasn't received. It was blocked. And now I think the world is so much more ready. And I want to emphasize that there now are second and third generations of survivors who can perpetuate these family stories. And in my temple, there is a group of children of survivors, and so second generation. And they are now working on involving the third generation because there's still family histories and photos and objects. And I think it is extremely important that these subsequent generations take on the responsibility and the need, the duty to provide the testimony once the first generation is no longer with us.
We heard from Sylvia in Framingham, Massachusetts, who shared her story. Here's what Sylvia left in our inbox.
4 days after Kristallnacht in 1938, my 40-year-old father and my 30-year-old mother were forced to flee their beloved home in Berlin. I was born in Antwerp, Belgium, in hiding. I am a hidden child survivor of the Holocaust. In 2002, I accepted honorary German citizenship. Tomorrow, I fly to Berlin to be part of the Kristallnacht commemoration. 80 years, when my parents fled their beloved home in Berlin. Murdered in Auschwitz, I preserve that memory forever. It is an imprint on my heart and my soul.
Wow. Sylvia, thank you so much for sharing your story. And hey, listen, if anybody out there like Sylvia is heading over for the commemoration, or if there are commemorations of Kristallnacht wherever you are in the country, if you're willing to share your stories with us, pictures, we'd be honored to see them. Feel free to continue this conversation online at the1a.org, or you're always welcome to leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. I know our time is short, Alexandra, but in terms of the effort to preserve these stories, especially in light of concerns about anti-Semitism today, give us one thing that you wish more people knew about the Holocaust, or something that you wish you could debunk for more people about the Holocaust.
I think it's the monolithic perspective on it. I think we just have to remember that individual people living in this history lived in the fullness of their time exactly the way that we do, with nuance and complexity, grappling with the reality of what was happening around them, whether they were victims or bystanders or perpetrators. Not to show compassion to perpetrators, but the point is that, you know, people living in their time live in complexity. There's a need, I think, for nuance and for us to grapple with that in the present.
Sarah, before we go?
I would add to it, at the moment, German policy was not genocide from the beginning. That evolved over a very long 8-year period. Even the Nazis were not ready day one to do this, although it was in the back of their minds. And so when people say, how could you not see the warning signs, that is looking back on history with hindsight. That's why using history to understand the warning signs today is very important, but we should not judge the people of that time who didn't see them clearly, like often the Jews of Germany did not.
And Rainey, what about you? What's the one thing you wish more people understood about the Holocaust?
Well, the importance of holding on to your humanity, not to succumb to the behavior of the masses, which included theft and fights and competition, but to care about other people as well as your own family, and to hold on to your dignity and respect for others, because that is what my parents taught me, and I think that shaped me for the rest of my life, and I wish more people had heard that lesson.
Well, more people are hearing the lesson. The three of you have certainly helped to make that happen, and we appreciate you sharing your story with us. Irene Butter, author of the memoir Shores Beyond Shores, From Holocaust to Hope, My True Story. Rainey, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Alexandra Zapruder, the author of Salvaged Pages, Young Writers' Diaries of the Holocaust, guest curator of an exhibition about young diarists for the Holocaust Museum Houston, which opens next year. Alexandra, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Sarah Bloomfield, the director of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum here in Washington. Sarah, thank you.
My pleasure.
Today's program was produced by Amanda Williams with support from our partners at Smithsonian Magazine. To learn more about Amanda and the rest of our staff, visit theoneA.org/staff. And remember, all that information about sharing your family stories is at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.